Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you 60 minutes of holiday-related readings about the black community. This week, I'll have a selection about Black Eyed Peas and Greens from the New York Times, a report from the Pew Research Center about religion in the black community, an exploration of holiday traditions from Essence Magazine, a short story from Langston Hughes, a reading about the history of macaroni and cheese, a story about Afro-Caribbean Christmas traditions. I'm going to wrap up with some prose by W.E.B. Du Bois, originally published in The Crisis magazine, and I'm starting with this story that ties together Kwanzaa and the Underground Railroad from the Windsor Star newspaper from Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Windsor is the city across the river from Detroit, Michigan. The title of the story is U.S. Man Walking from Windsor to Dresden to Honor Freedom Seekers. This was written by Trevor Terfloth and published November 28, 2025. To honor the freedom seekers that came before, a U.S. man will set out on foot from Windsor to Dresden for Kwanzaa. Ken Johnston of Philadelphia plans to make the 120-kilometer trek, Our Walk to Freedom, from December 26th to January 3rd, tracing the footsteps of those who escaped or evaded capture. On his journey, he will make stops at historic communities where early black settlers sought freedom, including Windsor, Sandwich First Baptist Church, Amherstburg Freedom Museum, Harrow, Buxton National Historic Site and Museum, Chatham-Kent Black Historical Society and Black Mecca Museum, and Josiah Henson Museum of African-Canadian History. Dresden and the Don Settlement have been home to free African-Canadians since the early 1800s. It became one of the earliest settlements for black Americans escaping slavery in the U.S. after passage of the British Slavery Abolition Act of 1833. This act, which took effect August 1, 1834, abolished slavery throughout the British Empire. The goal of the walk is to recall the hardships of slavery and the victory of freedom, Johnston said in a recent release. In learning about the history of enslaved people in the area, I wrongly believe blacks only passed through the area following the Underground Railroad as they fled to Canada. In fact, 200 years earlier, West Africans and the Anishinaabe, the indigenous people of the region, built the forts, trapped in processed beaver pelts, and tilled the land while enslaved by French and English colonizers as early as the 1600s in Wayeyatanog, the indigenous name for the Detroit area, known as where the water goes around. Johnston noted that one of the hardships was the winter climate. By tracing the footsteps of the ancestors through my public presentation of walking, I hope to evoke the power of memory to honor the resilient spirit of those who sought freedom during the dark winter months to reach Windsor, Sandwich, Amherstburg, Harrow, Buxton, Chatham, and Dresden, he said. Last summer, Johnston walked from Niagara Falls, New York, to Owen Sound, the northern terminus of the Underground Railroad, to explore the different directions freedom seekers entered Canada. The Windsor to Dresden walk is a continuation of a larger journey Johnston started in 2019 on Maryland's eastern shore, walking over 5 years to reach Owen Sound. Johnston has traveled across the United States, south from Selma to Memphis, Galveston to Houston during Juneteenth, and the Southern Road to Freedom along the banks of the Rio Grande River in Reynosa, Mexico. That was the story, U.S. Man Walking from Windsor to Dresden to Honor Freedom Seekers. This was written by Trevor Terfloth and published November 28, 2025, in the Canadian newspaper, The Windsor Star. Many activities this time of year are tied to religion. Next, I have a report about religion in the Afro-American community from the Pew Research Center. The title is Key Facts About Black Americans and Religion. This was written by Kiana Cox. and published December 2, 2025, at the website pewresearch.org. Black Americans are among the most religious groups in the United States, but religion differs substantially among Black Americans. Similarly to patterns seen among the U.S. population overall, older Black adults are more religious than younger Black adults, and women are more religious than men. Here are key facts about Black Americans and religion based on Pew Research Center's 2023 to 2024 Religious Landscape Study and other center surveys. 1. Most Black Americans are Christian, though the share who identify as such has fallen since 2007. About three-quarters of Black adults, 73%, are Christian, including 65% who are Protestant, 4% who are Catholic, and 4% who identify with other Christian groups such as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and Jehovah's Witnesses. The Christian share of Black adults is down from 79% in 2014 and 85% in 2007. Christian affiliation has similarly declined among the overall U.S. population during the time. Nonetheless, Black adults are more likely than U.S. adults overall to be Christian, 73% versus 62%. Only 4% of Black adults identify with non-Christian religions, including Islam. And 22% of Black adults are religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, or adults who are not affiliated with a religion, including 3% who identify as atheist or agnostic, and 19% who say their religion is nothing in particular. 2. By several measures, Black Americans are more religious than Americans of other races and ethnicities. Compared with white, Hispanic, and Asian adults, Black adults are more likely to believe in God or a universal spirit, 95%, and do so with absolute certainty, 74%. Black adults also are more likely than other racial or ethnic groups to say religion is very important in their lives, 58%, to pray daily, 64%, and to participate monthly in religious services, whether in person or online, 57%. Around half or fewer of African Americans and other racial or ethnic groups say religion is very important to them or pray daily. Even fewer attend religious services monthly. 3. Most Black adults who are religiously unaffiliated say they believe in God. Among Americans who do not identify with a religion, 83% of Black nuns, N-O-N-E-S, believe in God. Nuns who are Hispanic, 69%, white, 46%, or Asian, 42%, are less likely to do so. Black nuns also are likely than their counterparts in other racial or ethnic groups to say that people have a soul or spirit in addition to their physical body, 82%. And they're more likely to pray monthly or more often, 61%. 4. Most Black adults who attend religious services at least a few times a year, 61%, attend Black congregations. That is, ones where the senior religious leaders and the majority of the congregants are Black. A Pew Research Center study in 2021 found that Black congregations are more likely than non-Black congregations to offer Black Americans distinctive experiences. These experiences include sermons on race relations or racial inequality, expressive worship services, and a sense of racial affirmation or pride. In addition to distinctive worship experiences, historically Black houses of worship have long served as the civic center of Black communities, especially during key eras of Black history such as the abolitionist and civil rights movements. Today, Black houses of worship continue to offer Black communities support on issues of voting, health, and food security. 5. Black men are more likely than Black women to move away from Christianity as they age. Among Black Americans, men are about as likely as women to say they were raised as Christians, 81% versus 85%, but they are less likely to identify as Christians in adulthood, 67% versus 78%. Conversely, black men are more likely than black women to be religiously unaffiliated as adults, 27% versus 18%, and to say they have become less religious over the course of their lives, 24% versus 15%. The pattern is similar, but less pronounced among white adults. White men are less likely than white women to identify as Christians as adults, 60% versus 66%. They are highly more likely to be unaffiliated, 33% versus 28%, and to say they have become less religious over time, 33% versus 30%. Hispanic and Asian adults do not differ by gender on these questions. 6. More black women than men consider themselves very spiritual. Americans define spirituality in many ways, including through the connections they feel to the universe, nature, or humanity. Because there is no single way to measure spirituality, our religious landscape study asks multiple questions about spiritual beliefs, practices, experiences, and identities. Black women are slightly more likely than black men to consider themselves very spiritual, 50% versus 42%. They also are more likely than black men to listen to music, 80% versus 68%, or to look inward for spiritual reasons a few times a month or more often, 68% versus 57%. However, roughly equal shares of black women and men say they do each of the following monthly for spiritual reasons: meditate, 46% versus 45%, exercise, 45% versus 47%, visit a nature spot such as a waterfall, mountaintop, or river, 26% versus 26%, or practice yoga, 15% versus 13%. 7. Older black adults are more likely than younger black adults to describe themselves as very religious. For example, 39% of black adults ages 65 or older describe themselves this way, compared with 21% of black adults under 30. This age pattern is not unique to black Americans. White and Hispanic adults who are 65 and older also are more likely than their peers under 30 to describe themselves as very religious. Even so, black adults, regardless of age, are more likely than adults in other racial and ethnic groups to say they're very religious. 8. Younger black adults are more likely than their elders to believe in the spiritual energy of nature, according to another Pew Center survey from 2023. For example, black adults under 50 are more likely than their older peers to say spiritual energy can be found in memorial sites like graveyards and cemeteries, 73% versus 45%, and in animals, 67% versus 47%. That was the report titled Key Facts About Black Americans and Religion. This was written by Kiana Cox and published December 2, 2025 at the website pewresearch.org. My next reading is titled Tracing the Origins of a Black American New Year's Ritual. This was written by Kayla Stewart and published December 24, 2021 in the New York Times newspaper. Families have long embraced the tradition of eating black-eyed peas and greens on January 1st, but the inspiration for the ritual crosses cultures and continents. On New Year's Day, black American families around the country will sit down to eat a variation on green vegetables and cowpeas, joining in an enduring tradition meant to usher in opportunity in the year ahead. I don't let a New Year's Day go by without having some form of greens, pork, and black-eyed peas, the food historian Jessica B. Harris said. The choice of greens, usually cooked with pork for flavor, comes from the perception among black Americans that folded collard greens look like paper money, said Adrian Miller, an author and food scholar. Eating greens on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day is believed to bring about greater financial prosperity. The peas promise good luck, health, and abundance. But while these rituals have become largely associated with the American South, their roots can be traced back to the meeting of West African and European traditions, Mr. Miller said. Collard greens, for instance, originated in Northern Europe. Collards is a corruption of colewort. Colewort is any non-heading cabbage, said Dr. Harris, the author of High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. They became part of the foodways of African Americans. The Africanism is in the cooking of them, not in the green itself. That cooking method of long, low, and slow, and with the pot liquor being consumed, is a very different thing. And celebrating on the first day of the year is more of a global tradition, Mr. Miller said. In Italy, for example, lentils, said to resemble coins, are cooked down with pork and served for luck. In West Africa, he added, there were certainly auspicious days, but this day that the first day of the calendar year and doing something on that day would bring good luck, to my knowledge, doesn't exist in West African societies prior to European contact. West African spiritual practices often revolved around deities who had favorite foods like black-eyed peas, which are native to the continent. The forced migration of enslaved Africans to North America and their interactions with European colonists led to a convergence of customs. It's all kind of messy, Mr. Miller said, but you can see this process of cultural diffusion, borrowing, appropriation, all of those things that were happening in previous centuries to the point where it coalesces into the tradition we have now. Geography also played a role in the variety of interpretations that emerged. In regions of the country influenced by the British, collards or kale might be served on New Year's Day, while in states like Louisiana, where there was a stronger German influence, people often enjoyed cabbage. As white Americans looking to take on a wholly American identity began to reject European customs, black people found ways to transform those customs. When people abandon superstitions because they just seem antiquated, that creates a space for new associations to emerge, Mr. Miller said. Black and Southern traditions eventually became inextricable. The first documented Black New Year's celebration is recounted in Tony Tipton Martin's Jubilee, Recipes from Two Centuries of African American Cooking. In the book, she shares the origins of Watch Night, when black Americans congregated church for song, praise, and prayer before the stroke of midnight. During the first such event on December 31st, 1862, or Freedom's Eve, enslaved people in the South Carolina Low Country gathered in churches to await news of their freedom under the Emancipation Proclamation, which was to be signed on New Year's Day, 1863. Their celebrations included a menu of Hoppin' John, collard greens with hog jowls, and ribs. My point in publishing these stories in Jubilee was to be able to tell a broader story about African Americans and New Year's Eve, Miss Tipton Martin said. This allows you to see strains of African tradition in things we think about as classic America. The blurring of what Miss Tipton Martin calls good luck food traditions can lead to erasure. Amethyst Gonaway, a Low Country chef and writer, notes that people often refer to black-eyed peas and rice and Hoppin' John interchangeably. Both make appearances on black Americans' tables, but Hoppin' John is a one-pot meal of rice and field peas, a variety of cowpea that's largely available only in the Low Country. It is also a bit lighter and redder, and has a creamier consistency than its black-eyed cousin. It's important to make that distinction, because it's really the origins of those traditions that get lost, Ms. Ganaway said. So many people think that Gullah Low Country traditions and people are dying off. No, we're here, she added. It actually starts here, and it's important to remember that it starts here for a reason. So our identity, our food ways, aren't being erased and turned into this mainstream thing. Though New Year's culinary traditions persist across the South, Frederick Opie, a professor of history and food ways at Babson College in Massachusetts, noted that they can take on particular significance for black Americans. Is there a correlation between a society or a culture that has experienced a larger than usual sense of being oppressed and marginalized, and that the hope for the next year means possibly experiencing something better? I suspect that there is, he said. How people celebrate the new year is also essential to bringing in goodwill. Dr. Harris hosted parties for nearly two decades in the 1980s and 90s, serving a good luck menu to as many as 70 guests in her Brooklyn home. It was a grand thing to do, and I very much enjoyed doing it, she said. Black Americans have found celebration in other foods, too. J.J. Johnson, the chef and owner of Field Trip in New York, takes guidance from his grandmother, a North Carolina native, when he prepares her seafood gumbo, with a few alterations, on New Year's Eve. I was taught that if you were eating good going into the new year, then you would be good and you would be healthy, Mr. Johnson said. For me, a gumbo like this represents family, luxury, and joy. Though the menus may vary, the purpose is the same. The tradition has lived on because it's fun and it speaks to aspiration, Mr. Miller, the food scholar says. You also hope that no matter what your condition is, that there's always a brighter future. That was the New York Times newspaper article titled, Tracing the Origins of a Black American New Year's Ritual. This was written by Kayla Stewart and published December 24, 2021. My next reading is titled, Did You Know About These Black Holiday Celebrations Beyond Christmas? This was written by Melissa Noel and published December 22, 2024, in Essence Magazine's Essence.com website. December is a time of diverse celebrations throughout the African diaspora. While Christmas is widely commemorated, the month also features a tapestry of festivities that highlight the rich cultural heritage, unity, and resilience of Black people across the globe. These pan-African customs go beyond geographical borders, connecting people through shared traditions in the face of ongoing struggles. Junkanoo, J-U-N-K-A-N-O-O. Junkanoo, also known as Junkanoo and Junkanoo, is a celebration that dates back to the 1700s. The name is said to have been based on the legendary figure Junkanoo, a revered West African chief. This lively festival is a symbol of cultural identity in the Bahamas, but the holiday is also observed in various forms in Belize, Jamaica, and South Carolina. Junkanoo originated with enslaved Africans who were granted 3 days off each year: Christmas, Boxing Day, December 26, and New Year's Day. These occasions gave them the opportunity to exalt their heritage, their spiritual beliefs, and the heroes from their homeland. Even after the abolition of slavery, Junkanoo lore persisted and evolved. The holiday became a vital part of Bahamian culture and spread to other regions where African traditions were prevalent. The celebration is characterized by colorful and elaborate costumes, vibrant music featuring instruments like goatskin drums and cowbells, and spirited dancing. Participants often spend months creating their costumes, which are visually striking and exemplify fine craftsmanship. The primary Junkanoo activities take place on Boxing Day and New Year's Day. Kwanzaa. Kwanzaa, observed from December 26 to January 1st, honors African heritage and culture. Its name comes from the phrase Matunda ya Kwanzaa, which means first fruits in Swahili. It reflects the connection to African harvest festivals, welcoming the first fruits of the season. Each day of the week-long Kwanzaa commemoration is dedicated to one of seven guiding principles, including unity, self-determination, and creativity. The holiday was created by Professor Milana Karenga in 1966, during a turbulent period in the United States when anti-Black violence and racial tensions were high. Envisioned as a response to events like the 1965 Watts Rebellion in Los Angeles, which signaled the need for community building, Kwanzaa became a way for African Americans to reconnect with their African roots, strengthen familial bonds, and promote communal support. During Kwanzaa, families often gather to light the kinara, a candle holder with seven candles, discuss the principles of the day, and exchange homemade or educational gifts. The holiday has gained greater recognition and grown outside the United States over the years, including in Canada, South Africa, and Barbados. It serves as a meaningful way for African Americans and other people of African descent to celebrate their culture and values. Masquerade. During the Christmas season throughout the Caribbean, you will almost certainly hear the lively sounds of masquerade bands making their way through the streets. The dancing, drumming, elaborate costumes, and effigies of the colonial masquerade bands originated in religious festivals of the Igbo and Yoruba tribes of Nigeria. Blending indigenous and European influences, this holiday's practices take on unique forms across the different islands. Weneba Fancy Dress Festival. This event in Ghana is a dynamic and culturally significant celebration known locally as Kaka Motobi. Its rituals have deep historical roots and showcase the fusion of African and European influences. Its origins lie in colonial Ghana, when Dutch settlers would wear masks and costumes to New Year's Eve parties. These costumes often represented fanciful or scary characters. Ghanaians in Weneba, W-I-N-N-E-B-A, a town in the central region, began forming masquerade groups as early as the 1930s. The festival evolved as a form of cultural expression and social commentary. It allowed Ghanaians to honor their heritage and, in some cases, seemingly mock European life and dress through costumes and masks. The costumes are extravagant and have exaggerated features. The Fancy Dress Festival is held annually on the first day of January, marking the start of the year with a burst of color, music, and theatrical performances. Parang. Trinidad and Tobago may be known for soca and calypso, but during the holiday period, the islands are transformed into a bastion of spirited folk melodies known as parang music, P-A-R-A-N-G. Parang bands, which get their name from the Spanish word paranda, meaning a spree or fete, embody this holiday with vibrant performances. From October to early January, groups of singers called paranderos spread holiday cheer by visiting homes throughout the community to share gifts of Christmas songs. The custom of paranderos going from house to sing is often referred to as paranging. The practice can be traced back to the late 18th century, when migrant farmers from Venezuela and Colombia were brought to Trinidad and Tobago to work on cocoa plantations. These migrants were primarily of Amerindian, Spanish, Cocopañol, and African heritage. The mix of ethnicities is reflected in the music, with songs traditionally sung in Spanish and accompanied by instruments such as the cuatro, a four-stringed acoustic guitar, maracas, mandolins, and a box bass. Today there is also soca parang, which combines the rhythmic style of Trinidadian soca with traditional parang instruments and English lyrics. Parang is also appreciated and celebrated on other Caribbean islands, including Grenada, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and Barbados. Altogether, these vibrant festivities make the winter months a time of rich cultural expression steeped in history. Despite the odds, many African practices have been preserved and recognized all over the world. That was the article titled, Did You Know About These Black Holiday Celebrations Beyond Christmas? This was written by Melissa Noel and published December 22, 2024 at the Essence.com website. Next, a short story that's in the spirit of the season. The title of the story is Thank You, Ma'am, by Langston Hughes. This is from the book The Best Short Stories by Black Writers, the classic anthology from 1899 to 1967, edited by Langston Hughes, published in 1967. Thank You, Ma'am, by Langston Hughes. She was a large woman with a large purse that had everything in it but a hammer and nails. It had a long strap, and she carried it slung across her shoulder. It was about 11 o'clock at night, dark, and she was walking alone, when a boy ran up behind her and tried to snatch her purse. The strap broke with the sudden single tug the boy gave it from behind, but the boy's weight and the weight of the purse combined caused him to lose his balance. Instead of taking off full blast, as he had hoped, the boy fell on his back on the sidewalk, and his legs flew up. The large woman simply turned around and kicked him right square in his blue jean sitter. Then she reached down, picked the boy up by his shirt front, and shook him until his teeth rattled. After that, the woman said, "Pick up my pocketbook, boy, and give it here." She still held him tightly, but she bent down enough to permit him to stoop and pick up her purse. Then she said, "Now, ain't you ashamed of yourself?" Firmly gripped by his shirt front, the boy said, "Yes'm." The woman said, "What did you want to do it for?" The boy said, "I didn't aim to." She said, "You a lie." By that time, two or three people passed, stopped, turned to look, and some stood watching. "If I turn you loose, will you run?" asked the woman. "Yes'm," said the boy. "Then I won't turn you loose," the woman said. She did not release him. "Lady, I'm sorry," whispered the boy. "Mm-hmm. Your face is dirty, too. I got a great mind to wash your face for you. Ain't you got nobody home to tell you to wash your face?" "No," said the boy. "Then it will get washed this evening," said the large woman, starting up the street, dragging the frightened boy behind her. He looked as if he was 14 or 15, frail and willow wild, in tennis shoes and blue jeans. The woman said, "You ought to be my son. I would teach you right from wrong. Least I can do now is wash your face. Are you hungry?" "No'm," said the being dragged boy. "I just want you to turn me loose." "Was I bothering you when I turned that corner?" asked the woman. "No'm." "But you put yourself in contact with me," said the woman. "If you think that that contact is not going to last a while, you got another thought coming. When I gets through with you, sir, you gonna remember Miss Lula Bates Washington Jones." Sweat popped out on the boy's face and he began to struggle. Mrs. Jones stopped, jerked him around in front of her, put a half Nelson around his neck, and continued to drag him up the street. When he got to her door, she dragged the boy inside, down a hall and into a large kitchenette furnished room at the rear of the house. She switched on the light and left the door open. The boy could hear the roomers laughing and talking in the large house. Some of their doors were open, too, so he knew he and the woman were not alone. The woman still had him by the neck in the middle of her room. She said, "What is your name?"
"Roger."
"Then, Roger, you go to that sink and wash your face," said the woman, whereupon she turned him loose, at last. Roger looked at the door, looked at the woman, looked at the door, and went to the sink. "Let the water run until it gets warm," she said. "Here's a clean towel." "You gonna take me to jail?" asked the boy, bending over the sink. "Not with that face. I wouldn't take you nowhere," said the woman. "Here I am trying to get home to cook me a bite to eat, and you snatch my pocketbook. Maybe you ain't been to your supper either, late as it be. Have you?"
"There's nobody home at my house," said the boy.
"Then we'll eat," said the woman. "I believe you're hungry, or been hungry, to try to snatch my pocketbook."
"I want a pair of blue suede shoes," said the boy.
"Well, you didn't have to snatch my pocketbook to get some suede shoes," said Mrs. Lula Bates Washington Jones. "You could have asked me."
"Ma'am?"
The water dripping from his face, the boy looked at her. There was a long pause, a very long pause. After he had dried his face and, not knowing what else to do, dried it again, the boy turned around, wondering what next. The door was open. He could make a dash for it down the hall. He could run, 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 run.
The woman was sitting on the daybed. After a while, she said, "I were young once and I wanted things I could not get." There was another long pause. The boy's mouth opened. Then he frowned, not knowing he frowned. The woman said, "Mm-hmm. You thought I was going to say, but I didn't snatch people's pocketbooks." "Well, I wasn't going to say that." Pause. Silence. "I have done things, too, which I would not tell you, son. Neither tell God if he didn't already know. Everybody's got something in common. So you sit down while I fix us something to eat. You might run that comb through your hair so you will look presentable." In another corner of the room behind a screen was a gas plate in an icebox. Mrs. Jones got up and went behind the screen. The woman did not watch the boy to see if he was going to run now, nor did she watch her purse, which she left behind her on the daybed. But the boy took care to sit on the far side of the room, away from the purse, where he thought she could easily see him out of the corner of her eye if she wanted to. He did not trust the woman not to trust him, and he did not want to be mistrusted now. "Do you need somebody to go to the store?" asked the boy. "Maybe to get some milk or something?" "Don't believe I do," said the woman, "unless you just want sweet milk yourself. I was going to make cocoa out of this canned milk I got here." "That'll be fine," said the boy. She heated some lima beans and ham she had in the icebox, made the cocoa, and set the table. The woman did not ask the boy anything about where he lived or his folks, or anything else that would embarrass him. Instead, as they ate, she told him about her job in a hotel beauty shop that stayed open late, what the work was like, and how all kinds of women came in and out, blondes, redheads, and Spanish. Then she cut him a half of her 10-cent cake. "Eat some more, son," she said. When they were finished eating, she got up and said, "Now here, take this $10 and buy yourself some blue suede shoes. And next time, do not make the mistake of latching onto my pocketbook or nobody else's, because shoes got by devilish ways will burn your feet. I got to get my rest now, but from here on in, son, I hope you will behave yourself." She led him down the hall to the front door and opened it. "Good night. Behave yourself, boy," she said, looking out into the street as he went down the steps. The boy wanted to say something other than, "Thank you, ma'am," to Mrs. Lula Bates Washington Jones. But although his lips moved, he couldn't even say that as he turned at the foot of the barren stoop and looked up at the large woman in the door. Then she shut the door. That was the short story titled, "Thank You, Ma'am," written by Langston Hughes. A popular side dish with many meals during the holiday season is macaroni and cheese. Next, a reading about the chef that some say popularized the dish in the United States. The title is "The Enslaved Man Who Popularized Mac and Cheese." It was written by Lynn Brown, published November 26, 2025, at the British Broadcasting Corporation's website, bbc.co.uk. This year, as millions of families in the United States sit down to celebrate Thanksgiving, many will tuck into one of the most quintessentially American foods, macaroni and cheese. But while some sources trace the baked dish's mysterious origins to Italy or Switzerland, the dish as Americans know it today may have been popularized in the New World via an unlikely figure, an enslaved chef named James Hemings. In 1784, long before he became president, Thomas Jefferson was appointed United States Minister to France and brought Hemings with him. Jefferson wanted the young man to be trained as a chef so he could preside over the kitchen at Monticello, his plantation estate in Virginia. But Hemings was more than just Jefferson's potential chef. He was also the half-brother of Jefferson's first wife, Martha, and the brother of Sally Hemings, the enslaved girl who looked after Jefferson's daughter and later bore six of his children. Hemings' relationship with Jefferson is very interesting, said Nicole Brown, a historian at Monticello, noting that his familial connection may have given Hemings certain opportunities denied other enslaved people. He was constantly negotiating and renegotiating with Jefferson in ways that you might not traditionally think of an enslaved person being able to do. In Paris, Hemings trained both as a chef de cuisine and pastry chef. Hemings was not only one of the first French-trained chefs in the United States, but certainly one of the first black French-trained chefs, Brown said. After 5 years in Paris, Hemings brought his new skills back to the United States and served as Jefferson's head chef at Monticello, as well as in New York and Philadelphia, until he was able to negotiate his own freedom in 1796. Using French techniques such as braising, poaching, and sautéing, he created delicate dishes that would have been almost unheard of in 18th century America, including the snow egg, a poached meringue served floating in creme anglaise. Since pasta baked with cheese had become a popular dish in France by the time Hemings trained there, he likely learned this there and brought it back to the United States as well. As Hemings served these French-inspired dishes to dignitaries, American socialites, and many of the era's top tastemakers up and down the East Coast, many of his dishes and cooking methods became de rigueur in households already across the newly formed nation. According to Brown, most American foods of this time would have been cooked over a hearth or in an open fireplace. Hemings' dishes, however, required more advanced methods and a stew stove, the precursor to the modern stove, which would have allowed for greater control over the heat. As the well-to-do guests who dined with Jefferson wanted to emulate Hemings' cooking style, the enslaved chef began to heavily influence the United States culinary culture. The way that we eat in America, the way that we cook, the foods that we celebrate, all these different things come to us through the lens of that one moment where Thomas Jefferson brought this person to Paris, said Chef Omar Tate, whose newly opened Philadelphia restaurant, Honeysuckle, serves dishes from across the African diaspora. He technically was a celebrity chef because everyone knew the slave that Thomas Jefferson had in his kitchen. The baked dish then called macaroni pie was a particular favorite of Jefferson's and was frequently served at his table. Hemings' version was created by cooking the macaroni in a mixture of milk and water, and then layering cheese and butter with the cooked pasta before baking. It's unknown whether the macaroni pie served at Monticello during Hemings' time as chef was a faithful recreation of what was being served in Paris during the late 18th century, or whether Hemings altered it to suit his own, or more likely, Jefferson's tastes. What is known is that over the following century, dishes resembling Hemings' version became more widespread across the U.S., helped along by a combination of broader trends. First, the influx of Italian immigrants in the 1880s increased the availability of pasta in the U.S. At the same time, industrialization transformed both pasta making and cheese making, allowing factories to mass produce ingredients that would previously have been difficult to obtain. In 1937, the Kraft Company introduced a boxed version of macaroni and cheese as a cheap and easy meal during the Great Depression. The slogan was, "Make a meal for four in 9 minutes." During World War II, people would purchase two boxes for a single ration point, cementing its place in American home cooking. Today, mac and cheese is a $2.9 billion industry, and some sources say the average American eats it 22 times a year, second only to pizza. Yet, the man who may have first introduced it to American diners is only now becoming more widely recognized. At Monticello, guests can learn about Hemings' legacy on the museum's From Slavery to Freedom walking tour, which honors the more than 600 men, women, and children enslaved at the plantation from 1770 until Jefferson's death in 1826. The museum's website also sheds light on Hemings' fascinating life, including the fact that he earned a minimum wage in Paris even as an enslaved man, which allowed him to hire a French tutor while living abroad. Hemings' story has also been featured in books and documentaries, including an episode on Stephen Satterfield's Netflix series, High on the Hog, and the documentary, James Hemings, Ghost in America's Kitchen. Hemmings' legacy is part of a growing understanding of how much of the United States food culture can be traced back to enslaved African Americans, whose roles in shaping popular American dishes have largely been unacknowledged. These include figures like Hercules Posey, the enslaved chef who cooked for George Washington and was known for his complex sauces and dishes like oyster stew, as well as the countless unnamed black cooks and caterers who brought dishes like rice, cornbread, and grits, some of which also have Native American roots, to American tables. Hemmings was this incredible person with this really powerful personality, said Brown. He is so unique in that he's better educated than most people in the United States. And yet, because you are deemed as being black and enslaved, you never attain the equality that a white person in that position would have. More than 200 years after his death, one of America's first celebrity chefs is now finally being recognized for his contributions to the nation's food culture. That was the article titled, The Enslaved Man Who Popularized Mac and Cheese. This was written by Lynn Brown, published November 26, 2025, at the British Broadcasting Corporation's website, bbc.co.uk. My next reading about holidays looks at the Caribbean. It's titled, To Celebrate Christmas, Each Island Has Its Traditions. This was published by the Philadelphia Tribune newspaper on December 15, 2023, and was written by the Philadelphia Tribune editors. Some people still ask, do the Caribbean islands celebrate Christmas? Of course they do. Maybe not the same way as here in the United States. But when you see all the homes and businesses lit up, poinsettias everywhere, decorated palm trees or pine trees if one can be found, and people getting their costumes ready for a Junkanoo parade, you'll know that it is definitely Christmas. Reflecting back on Christmas as a child in the Caribbean, most people remember cleaning the house, decorating with balloons and cray paper, making do-it-yourself Christmas cards, baking Christmas cakes, black cakes or fruit cakes, and preparing for the big Christmas play at church. There is no memory of being told stories about Santa coming down the chimney with gifts because we didn't have chimneys and most parents could not afford to buy a bunch of Christmas gifts back in the 1960s and 70s. And it is still financially challenging for some today. What are some common names for Santa Claus in the islands? In the English-speaking Caribbean, the most common names are Santa Claus, Saint Nick, and Father Christmas. In the Spanish-speaking Caribbean, he is known as Papa Noel or San Nicolas. In the French-speaking Caribbean, he is Père Noël or Daddy Christmas. And in the Dutch-speaking Caribbean, he is Sinterklaas. Christmas was banned in Cuba from 1969 until 1998 because Cuban leader Fidel Castro didn't want any religious celebrations. The island resumed its celebration of Christmas when Pope John Paul II visited in 1998. A must-have for a Cuban Christmas dinner is roasted pork with plantains, usually accompanied by black and white beans and Cuban bread. In Antigua and Barbuda, Christmas is all about stilt walkers, John Bull, Long Ghost, and Jumpabin, based on African witch doctors. Popular drinks such as fermented Christmas bush, ginger and water molasses is paired with food choices like mutton, fowl, pork, turkey, duck, ham, cakes, and tarts. The poorest people can only afford pork and fried dumplings, but they are grateful for what they have. Aruba celebrates Christmas by honoring Sinterklaas. Every November, thousands of people gather to see him arrive on the steamboat from Spain at the harbor of Aranjestad, the capital. The event is broadcast on television for families throughout the island. Sinterklaas then rides through the city on a white horse and tosses candy and gingerbread cookies to children. Children put a treat inside their shoe and place it outside for Sinterklaas's horse the night before. They leave a letter telling him what gift they would like. On December 5th, they awake to find the horses' treats gone, with Santa Claus having left toys and sweets in their place, depending on whether they were good or bad. People in Barbados traditionally attend church services on Christmas Day. Queen's Park is popular for its music, socializing, and a chance for people to show off their finest clothes. That is followed by a big family dinner with traditional dishes such as roast pork, baked ham, jug jug, and rum cake. Belize, in the Western Caribbean, has rum popo, similar to eggnog with rum during the holidays. Locals look forward to the 10-day procession recreating Mary and Joseph's journey before the birth of Jesus. There is lots to do in the Cayman Islands at Christmas, from light displays to beach parties. Caribbean Santa appears at Camana Bay, dressed in shorts and flip-flops. Christmas is a time for family dinners that usually feature Cayman Christmas beef, along with cassava, heavy cake, fruit cake, and sorrel. In the Dominican Republic, there are no fir trees, so they improvise and make charmicos, small Christmas trees made with straw, branches, and wood, painted white to look like snow. There are parties that move from house to house as people join in. A favorite dish is roast pork tamales served in banana leaves. In Trinidad and Tobago, the upbeat Venezuela-Trinidad music called parang is played. In the evenings, paranderos, like carolers, go from house to house singing Christmas songs. Sometimes they are rewarded with food and drink if the homeowner likes the song. Preparation for the Christmas Day meal starts in early December. The traditional meal includes apples and grapes, sorrel, poncha de creme, a version of eggnog, ham, turkey, homemade bread, ginger beer, pasteles, a version of tamales, and local wine. Each island may have its own unique way of celebrating Christmas, but there is one thing that is very important to all of us, spending the time with our family and friends. That is the gift that keeps on giving, and it doesn't matter whether you are rich or poor, because everyone can afford it. That was the Philadelphia Tribune newspaper article titled, "To Celebrate Christmas, Each Island Has Its Traditions." This was published December 15, 2023, and was written by the Philadelphia Tribune editors. I'm wrapping up this African American Hour with a reading from the December 1, 1921 edition of Crisis Magazine that blends together the story of the wise men and the Beatitudes. The title is The Sermon in the Cradle by W.E.B. Du Bois, who at the time was the editor of The Crisis. The Crisis has been in print since 1910 and is the oldest black-oriented magazine in the world. The Sermon in the Cradle by W.E.B. Du Bois. Now, when Jesus was born in Benin of Nigeria in the days of English rule, behold, there came wise men from the east to London, saying, "Where is he that is born king of the blacks? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him." When the prime minister had heard these things, he was troubled, and all England with him. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scholars of the land together, he demanded of them where this new Christ should be born. And they said unto him, "In Benin of Nigeria, for thus it was written by the prophet, 'And thou, Benin, in the land of Nigeria, art not the least among the princes of Africa, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my negro people.'" Then the prime minister, when he had privily called the wise men, inquired of them diligently what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Benin and said, "Go and search diligently for the young child, and when ye have found him, bring me word again, that I may come and worship him also." When they had heard the premier, they departed. And lo, the star which they saw in the east went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother, and fell down, and worshipped him. And when they opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold, and medicine, and perfume. And being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to England, they departed into their own country another way, save one, and he was black, and his own country was the country where he was. So the black wise man lingered by the cradle and the newborn babe. The perfume of his gift rose and filled the house, until through it and afar came the dim form of years and multitudes. And the child, seeing the multitudes, opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are poor folks, for they shall go to heaven. Blessed are sad folks, for someone will bring them joy. Blessed are they that submit to hurts, for they shall sometime own the world. Blessed are they that truly want to do right, for they shall get their wish. Blessed are those who do not seek revenge, for vengeance will not seek them. Blessed are the pure, for they shall see God. Blessed are those who will not fight, for they are God's children. Blessed are those whom people like to injure, for they shall sometime be happy. Blessed are you, black folk, when men make fun of you, and mob you, and lie about you. Never mind, and be glad, for your day will surely come. Always the world has ridiculed its better souls." The Sermon in the Cradle, written by W.E.B. Du Bois and published December 1, 1921, in The Crisis Magazine. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.